We are continuing now with this series in 2 Timothy chapter 2, page 996 in the Pew Bibles. Follow along as I read it. Now, in a great house, there are not only vessels of gold and silver, but also of wood and clay, some for honorable use, some for dishonorable. Therefore, if anyone cleanses himself from what is dishonorable, he will be a vessel for honorable use, set apart as holy, useful to the master of the house, ready for every good work. So flee youthful passions and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace, along with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. The theme for this section in these three verses comes in the preceding verse, verse 19. Let everyone who names the name of the Lord depart from iniquity. The idea is fairly straightforward. Paul is saying to Timothy, and by extension to those in his congregation under his care, look, you claim to be a disciple of this Jesus. You claim to love him, to follow him, to belong to him. And so, why aren't you more like him? This is why people always have to find a way to change Jesus if they are going to change their own understanding of holiness. That is, if you consider yourself a Christian, there's some intuitive sense that I really ought not to be advocating something that's too far from who Jesus was and what he did. And so if you want to have a revisionist ethic on sexual immorality or any sort of morality, you have to find a way to soften Jesus, to make him into something different, because we understand that if we name the name of Christ, then we ought to bear some resemblance to Christ. So Paul makes his point using an analogy and an exhortation. He talks about houses in verses 20 and 21, and then he talks about youth. That's what I want to talk about tonight. Houses and youth. Think of it as a mix between MTV and HGTV. I know that people still watch HGTV because it's on in my house. I am not sure whether they watch MTV, though I imagine they shouldn't. But this is about houses and about youth. Verse 20, in a great house, he says, there are not only vessels of gold and silver, but also of wood and clay, some for honorable use, some for dishonorable. And you understand the analogy, speaking of a great house, however you might imagine this. We might have in our mind some Downton Abbey sort of mansion or something, but it probably wasn't that great of a house, but a significant dwelling where the prominent people would live, those who are well off or well to do. And within this house, if you were in the upper crust, you would have different sort of serving utensils. Probably many of us have the same. The nice IKEA multicolored set that you have for your kids, you probably didn't put out for your special guest today. Although if you did, I would say go for it. But you probably had some special set for your family or friends. Unless you had a very big gathering, then you do paper plates, and that's good too. Very easy. Here in the house, he speaks of those vessels that are for honorable use. So he's thinking of gold and silver, those vessels that speak of ornamentation. You can picture those for a public dinner. Think of someone bringing goblets for wine or platters for food. And then there are those vessels for dishonorable use. What he says here are made of wood and clay, earthenware. Now you may have in your mind, well, what about 2 Corinthians 4, where it is said to our credit that we have this treasure in jars of clay, same kind of language, in cracked pots and just very common vessels. Well, it's a different idea using the same sort of analogy. So Paul's point in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 is that though we may be beset by many weaknesses. And there, by weaknesses, he means physical infirmities, or you may not be impressive by the world's standards. Not many of you were wise or rich or laudable. Though you may look to be very ordinary, that just exalts the gospel even more to have this treasure in jars of clay. Here, when he talks about vessels made of wood and clay, he's thinking not of physical weakness so much as moral turpitude. That is, those who are failing to live up to God's righteous standard. And it's actually important that we understand both of these, because sometimes you will find people who are making very light of sanctification who will say, well, you know, we're just all cracked pots and we're earthen vessels and scum of the earth and, you know, God just has this treasure in us, all of which is true. But if people use that to mean, well, I'm really just a very casual sinner, and I'm just a spiritual failure without any sort of striving for righteousness because, hey, look at me, I'm a jar of clay. Well, that's not what Paul means in 2 Corinthians 4. In fact, that would be the wrong sort of jar of clay that he's referencing here in 2 Timothy chapter 2. Those vessels that are used for dishonorable use. It is a comparison between the fine china and the paper plates, or to put it more drastically, between the silver tea kettle. Would you like a spot of tea? That's what my kids were practicing saying when we were overseas. Would you like a tea from this magnificent tea kettle, or would you like to take door number 2, a diaper pail? Okay, you can understand. Honorable, dishonorable. I'm going to maybe take my chances over here, not so much over here. When he speaks of a house, he's thinking likely of the church, the household of faith, he says in 1 Timothy 3:15, which is the church of the living God. Now, he's not laying down a blueprint for the church. He's not saying the idea in the church is I want you to have some real honorable people and I want you to have some dishonorable people. He's not describing how things ought to be, but he is describing how things often are. He's speaking in the broadest terms regarding the Christian community. And he's saying, look into the household of faith. Now, Timothy, as a pastor, I want you to look. There's false teachers. There's people who are pursuing wrong ideologies and wrong ethical moralities. And I want you to see, and I want you to judge and evaluate. Where's the fine china and where's the diaper pail? What kind of stuff gets poured out of you? Does it seem like you're the sort of person we were to bring you in this vessel? What sort of vessel are you? If we bring you to the fancy dinner and we tip you over and someone has their cup there, what comes out of your serving vessel? You're poured out. Is it criticism? Wrangling? Relational breakdowns, that's what's happened. Whenever you go and you pour out some of your life, that's what results. Or, wherever you go, what gets poured out from this vessel of honor is service, help, ministry, joy, love. What sort of vessel are you in the household of God? He says in verse 21, if anyone cleanses himself from what is dishonorable, he will be a vessel for honorable use, set apart as holy, useful to the master of the house, ready for every good work. In Timothy's context, it means cleanse yourself from what is immoral, separate from false teachers, don't give them a hearing, don't pursue their course of action, don't imitate their teaching or their way of life, don't go rummaging around in their garbage. Striking to me that the contrast here is between honor and dishonor. By and large, I don't think we deal with these categories in the contemporary Western world, at least. We're not often talking about what is honorable or dishonorable. I think I mentioned to you before this very fascinating book. I would commend you to read it, though it's not a Christian book, and you have to filter through a lot of just evolutionary bias and how he sort of understands the world. But it's called The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T. And one of the things that is so fascinating is he looks at how people make decisions, and he thinks in particular about politics and religion. He says, how do people shape their moral matrix? How do they make ethical decisions? And though his whole life has been, you know, we might say politically leaning more toward the liberal side, he has come to see that there's something missing. And so his argument is that people now, especially those who are young, only know how to make moral decisions based on what he calls the care versus harm axis. That's almost entirely how people make their moral decisions. Would anybody be hurt by that? And he has all of these really disturbing sorts of tests that he gives to people, where he'll lay out a scenario for somebody, usually for his college students. And it might be a scenario where somebody, I mean, just really shocking things. He tries to make it as shocking as possible, like a brother and sister go away on a ski retreat, just the two of them, and they decide to have relations with one another, and they take all the precautions, and nobody's going to get pregnant, nothing bad will happen, and it's just a very meaningful time for them. Do you think what they did is right or wrong? And though there's a visceral reaction among these young students, they have no moral categories for concluding that that might be wrong. Because they only, he's arguing, they only can make decisions on this care versus harm axis. And so if you remove that from them, you say, nope, everyone felt good about it, nobody was hurt by it, no bad ramifications, just pretending that there weren't, nothing bad would happen, is it okay? And though they feel a visceral sort of reaction that it must be something wrong, they don't have the moral framework anymore. So he says we are missing concepts of loyalty, authority, sanctity, how to place honor within this moral matrix. Honor versus dishonor. It's very much how they would have operated in biblical times and even more in Eastern cultures would continue to operate. Well, that's shameful. That doesn't honor your parents. That doesn't honor your family. And we've lost that. I'll give you another book that I read a few years ago called Honor, A History. A History of Honor. Again, I don't know if the author is a Christian, and I found parts of it. I think I'm not sure he understands Christianity perfectly by any means. But the thesis of his book is that this older kind of honor and this honor code has been lost. So he argues that this began to happen in our culture at breakneck speed in the 1960s, where a youth culture developed to rival the dominant culture, and what was once considered honorable became dishonorable. So that the new hero is the anti-hero. He says, quote, one whose heroism consists less in doing than in suffering and having suffered. So that we no longer honor those who do their duty and keep their word and bravely face the enemy. We bestow honor on those who reveal personal authenticity. I made up a phrase. I call it the Shrekification of heroism. Remember it when Shrek came out, and it was a big deal because it was sort of the anti-hero. You have the ogre who doesn't become a prince, but rather, sorry, spoiler alert, but the princess becomes an ogre, an ogress, I'm not sure, at the end of the movie. And it was to show that really what the hero is to be authentic to yourself. And the new hero is this sort of anti-hero. And nobility is less about overcoming weakness and more about learning to be yourself. The older courage was about allegiance to external imperatives and expectations. The new courage is about being true to your own physical or psychic reality and your inner self. It's fascinating. And when I come upon these terms, honor and dishonor, which would have had so much cultural traction in their day. And then I put them up against our own moral matrix. And the juxtaposition is striking because I don't think we have these categories anymore. Simply say, whether anyone was hurt, or you can point to your own damage or did you hurt another human being, what you have done is not honorable. It's dishonorable. If you are a vessel for honorable use, Paul says, you will be set apart as holy. You will be fine china in God's cabinet. You will be the gold platter that God uses for the most important occasions. Useful to the master of the house. Now, we want to be careful. We don't want to think that God is needy and he only can use the best people. But take this at face value. What a compliment. What a compliment that you might be useful to the master of the house. The God of the universe who needs nothing, lacks for nothing. And yet Paul says, if you cleanse yourself from all that nasty worldly garbage, you make yourself an honorable vessel. The master of the house himself looks at you and says, now that's a woman I'm going to put out and I'm going to parade. That's the man that I'm going to use. Useful to the master of the house. Whether you think you serve any great cultural purpose, whether you feel like your days are just spent toiling as a mother or father or student, or you feel infirmed, or you feel like you're in a dead-end job or whatever, if you are cleansed from what is dishonorable and you present yourself to the Lord as one who is honorable, you will be useful to the master of the house. Do you see here how the fruit of the Spirit is so much more important than the gifts of the Spirit? Oh, we're thankful for the gifts of the Spirit. We really recognize them quickly in people. But it's the fruit of the Spirit that the Lord most uses. Some of us will be silver salt shakers, some golden goblets, some rare serving dishes. What matters is that we are set apart as holy. If you think to yourself, I want, in whatever years I have remaining on this earth, to be of maximum usefulness to my God, here's what you do. You pursue holiness. You say, well, maybe I should get another degree. Maybe you should. Some people do that when they get old and they still are going after degrees. Maybe you think, well, I ought to learn a language. I ought to lose some weight. Oh, anything could be helpful. But here's what you do if you really want to be useful. You pursue holiness. Isn't that what Peter says in 2 Peter? That if you are found with these things in increasing measure, love and faith and knowledge and goodness, you will not be found ineffective or unfruitful in the knowledge of God. That's what makes us fruitful as a pastor, an elder, a deacon, a small group leader, a high school student, a nursery worker, a volunteer. What you need to pursue most is not the latest how-to book or the most capable abilities or even financial security or discovering your spiritual gift. What is most needed is your pursuit of holiness, that you might be ready for every good work. I like that image. Are you the sort of person that God can pull off the shelf in almost any situation? And you're prepared, and you're ready to go. Now, you may have 5 talents or 10 talents or 2 talents or 1 little talent you're tempted to bury in the ground. But if you're mature, reliable, steady, discerning, wise, courageous, careful, and compassionate, then do you see you are like the Lord whose name you bear? You are like the master of the house? And did you notice in that list of virtues I just gave, those don't come overnight. This is why the new sort of moral matrix is so much more attractive than the old one. Because if you are going to be a person who's mature, reliable, steady, discerning, wise, courageous, careful, compassionate, that sort of character is forged through suffering, through discipline, through hard work, through many trials. But if what matters and what is honorable is simply authenticity, or to be in touch with yourself, or to sort of look askance at others and have the cynic's furrowed brow and laughter all the time. Well, that can be gotten, you know, by the time you're a freshman in college, can't it? And in fact, it can be worn very well. But it isn't the sort of honor that the Lord is after. Which leads us to the second point. We've looked at this analogy of a house, and then we come to the exhortation. Very simply, flee youthful passions. Youthful passions refer, as we'll see in a moment, to sensuality and sexual lust, but more broadly, to impetuous passions that are found more frequently in the young. Timothy, you remember, was young. Let no one despise you for your youth, Paul said, but set the believers an example in speech, in conduct, in love, in faith, in purity. And we get an idea what Paul has in mind by these youthful passions by seeing what he calls Timothy to in the second half of the verse. So flee, here's what you're running away from, youthful passions. And so what are you running toward? Righteousness, faith, love, and peace. So we don't just have flee, shun, avoid. We have pursue, run after, strive. Run away from misplaced passions and run hard after Christ-like pursuits. And I think you could make the case that the four virtues he talks about here correspond to some of the vices most prevalent in the youth. And let's say any of us who still have some of that youthful indiscretion in us. When I started in ministry, I could preach a sermon like this about the young people and they'd feel like I was, well, talking to myself, and now you don't feel like that anymore. But it's true, and it needs to be said. Instead of a passion for sensuality, pursue righteousness. What is the model of young men and young women we see in our culture? You look at magazines, movies, television programs. They are not going to help you, by and large, seek the things that make you more like Christ. Now, I don't think that young people are more sinful today than they are in other ages. Human nature is the same. We're still often stupid, usually sinful. But here's what has changed. The sins of youthfulness are more acceptable. In fact, they have been catered to, and they have been made the dominant culture. A nihilistic, sex-crazed, humorously cynical, entertainment-driven, celebrity-infatuated, fleeting, traditionless, rootless youth culture. So that once was, well, that's the young people, has become all of us. Think of the image of a young male promoted and marketed. You have the loafer man, stupid, beer-guzzling, partying, addicted to sports, but not good at any of them. He's cynical, irresponsible, crude, lazy, obsessed with sex. You got that sort of genre. Or you have the all-conquering alpha male, high-powered, materialistic, muscle-bound, thrill-seeking, get out of my way, make a lot of money, buy a lot of gadgets, also obsessed with sex. That's what you see. Well, that's what manhood looks like. About womanhood. You have the loose female. She's also stupid, addicted to celebrity gossip and partying and body conscious and scantily clad, mall shopping, deliriously emotional and obsessed with sex. Or you have the cosmopolitan female. Who's a take charge, sexy, get out of my way, materialistic, I can have it all, man-eating, also obsessed with sex. That's sort of the... And our world has no idea even what men or women should look like, except to put these gross anomalies before us. I imagine if you were to pick up some of the magazines that are promoted and marketed to young women, you will get a whole host of mixed messages. You'll have in some of those magazines at the checkout lines, on the one hand, you'll have articles about don't let anyone tell you that you're not good enough, and then the next article will be 15 ways to lose 15 pounds in 15 days. Well, You don't need a man to be happy, and here's 15 ways to have better sex. Do you see that our world doesn't understand? Here's, this will be sobering for you. This is in the latest issue of Christianity Today, and there was this, this was conducted by Josh McDowell Ministries and the Barna Group, a survey of today's young adults, not Christian, just anyone, 13 to 24-year-olds. Okay, I'm looking out here. We do have, thank you, I'm glad you're here. We have some 13 to 24-year-olds. We have even some people who will be, Lord willing, 13 to 24-year-olds. We have more people who, if you can remember, were 13 to 24-year-olds. This is not surprising, but mind-blowing. So here's a list ranked from least immoral to most immoral. I don't know how what exactly the question was. Maybe they had to give a number to it, but this is the aggregate score here. So I'll go up from the bottom. This is 13 to 24-year-olds, least immoral, watching explicit television or movies. Next up, reading erotic or pornographic content. Next, this is I'm starting from least immoral, viewing pornographic images, coveting others' possessions, wasting electricity or water, overeating, thinking negatively about someone else. Okay, we're going from least immoral. Here, everything that's at the bottom there, there's more. Thinking negatively about someone else, not recycling, lying, adultery, stealing. So to go into your room and fire up your computer and look at whatever you want to look at, pornographic images, is, according to the average 13 to 24-year-old in America, far, far less serious than if you put your milk jug in the wrong container. Now, if recycling is going to help preserve something of our environment, go for it. But I can say on the authority of God's word, you do not go to hell for not recycling. But in all seriousness, your soul is at stake. For these things, for this pursuit of sensuality, they asked, I am comfortable with how much porn I use. Practicing Christians, 39% said they were comfortable. Non-Christians, 73%. I would rather not use porn at all. Practicing Christians, 40%. Only 40%. All others, 14%. I feel a sense of guilt when I use porn. Young Christian adults, 34%. All others, 15%. Porn has negatively affected my sex life. Christians, 6%. All others, 5%. We have a world that is completely upside down. And it is a world in which there is extreme judgmentalism about almost everything. How you raise your kids, or what food you eat, or what you drive, or how you live. Extreme judgmentalism about almost anything except on this issue of sex. So I'm not saying that young people are more interested in sex than they were 1,000 years ago. You read through history and there were illegitimate all sorts of things. People are the same. What's changed is a loss of honor and dishonor. No sense of shame for what truly ought to be shameful. No longer the moral category to even understand why Paul might tell young Timothy, flee youthful passions. Pursue righteousness. Then we see, instead of a passion for novelty and fads, he says, pursue faith. Pursue what is steady and lasting. This is the plight of the young often is they see something, it's new, it's better. Oh, the church is old, we must change or die, reinvent everything. I'm the first person to ever see this way. I'm just getting out all my speeches ready as my kids come into their teenage years. If I tell people that I'm a conservative, it means different things, and people maybe hear theological things or political things. I'm not speaking here in a political sense. If I were to say we're a conservative, I would mean it in two ways. I would mean, one, I have a belief in the constancy of human nature. And two, I believe in conserving the wisdom from the past. Now, you could use the word liberal, and you could show the whole history of, you know, our whole political system, which actually today reflects sometimes conservatives, was called liberal once upon a time. So words change and their meanings change. So I'm not about trying to get you all to use the label, but I am wanting to put forth the idea that as God's people, we are liberal in our affections, liberal in our generosity, and we are conservative in our understanding of human nature and truth. We believe that people have seen things before that we need to listen to. Isn't that what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15? I'm passing on to you what was also given to me. Isn't that what he tells Timothy? Guard the good deposit. There is something here to preserve and conserve. So we're not looking to reinvent the church. We're looking to conserve and preserve what is true in the faith. And then instead of passion for righteous indignation, he says, pursue love. And of course, young people love to talk about love, but I would argue it's often as a slogan, not as the real thing. What is love? Love is to be kind and patient, not rude, not self-seeking, not boastful. Love is usually just something you slap on a bumper sticker to say the people you disagree with are wrong. Are you pursuing love, or is it a righteous indignation? I've probably already had too many little asides in this sermon, but you're the few, the proud, the brave, and you come out on Easter Sunday evening. So I'll give you one more. I read an interesting article this week which is trying to describe the political situation in this election cycle, and saying what is gone is an aspirational politics, any sort of, you know, a better day, brighter. What's here and seems to be succeeding is resentment politics. You've been hurt, you've been wronged, you're angry. Who can be the most outraged? And it fits perfectly with a world dominated by social media, where what gets attention is whoever can be the most outraged and say the most outrageous thing. And it does not appeal, as Lincoln would say, to the better angels of our nature, to that which might cause us to pursue what is honorable, but rather taps into a sense of resentment, anger, indignation. It usually works. Paul says, finally, instead of a passion for fights and quarrels, I want you to pursue peace. This is what he'll talk about in the following verses, 23. Have nothing to do with foolish, ignorant controversies. You know that they breed quarrels, and the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome. This, again, Paul says, is a penchant for the young, for the immature, ready to fight at everything. There are people who will not fight for anything, and there are people who have never met a mountain that they aren't eager to die on. If you noticed in Nate's sermon last week, as he talked about those who are just filled with speculations, he said two things. He said, what we're against here are those things that are unimportant or unknowable. Not to say, well, you know, suddenly you don't care about doctrine or you don't care about secondary issues, and if it's not a salvation issue, who cares? That's not the point about being argumentative or quarrelsome. There are things we must fight about, things we must die for. But if the issue is unimportant and unknowable, and if it's unknowable, it's often unimportant. That's what he's talking about. The sort of speculations, the genealogies and the endless spinning out of theories and mysteries, saying it doesn't profit anything. Age often gives perspective on what is important and how slowly most things and most people change. Of course, the danger with old age is perhaps you become too soft. Perhaps you lose some edges that you ought to have had. But with age comes some perspective. If you want to read a mature Christian in full flower, just read anything by John Newton. Newton said later in life, "Over my 30 years, I have seen some of my mountains lowered and some of my valleys raised. Should I expect my opponents to come to the same understanding in merely a year or two?" It's a good question. He said, "Look, I'm an old man. I've lived a lot of life. And I've seen some things I didn't think were very important, and I see how important they are. And I had some things that I was just ready to fight tooth and nail, and I've seen some of those mountains lowered, and it's taken me a long time to get there. So I'll be patient with others as they get there too." I've often thought that one of the great secrets to our success as a church, to put it in human terms, one of our secrets to success is that this church has such a healthy mix of those who are younger and those who are older. And as the younger people come in, and they're always coming, and they always get younger and younger. How does that happen? And, you know, college freshmen who are born in the 90s, what? As the younger keep coming and coming, it helps the older to still dream dreams, still believe in big visions. I've often thought it's been so good that we have so many college students who come in and come out, and internationals who come in and come out. And I think it's helped us to not fight with each other quite so much. We say, well, there's more people to love. There's more people to reach. There's more people to disciple. And at the same time, to be a church that not just has, you know, 20 to 25-year-olds running the show, discipling other 20 to 25-year-olds, but those who have lived some life, who walk with a limp like Jacob when the Lord touched his hip socket, to help the younger understand that change and discipleship is a program of decades, not of days, to have a ballast in the boat. And I can look out even here, and I won't name your names, but see people who have been here for years and for decades, and you've moved from the younger to the older now. And I think this church is what it is under God, because people like you have held a steady grip and a sure gaze with wisdom and maturity that I know whatever foolish things the young may do and whatever foolish things I might have done when I came here as the 26-year-old, it wouldn't get too bad too quickly with the likes of many of you that I can name and love. Flee youthful passions. Pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace. For better or worse, young people often set the tone in our world. They are the desired demographic. People are wanting to see, do we have a new crop of young leaders? Is this appeal to the 18 to 29-year-old? How often, how many times in a week do you see some new survey, some new article about the millennials? What do they think? What are they like? How can we understand them? Because there's tens of millions of them, they must all be exactly alike. It's a youth-dominated world. And that's worse, but it could be for good. What kind of generation will you be? I know we just have a few younger souls here tonight, but there's enough. Some ones not quite teenagers, some in the middle of their teens, a good number of 20-somethings. You know, the world doesn't expect much from you. They don't expect you to go and fight and win wars. They used to do that. They don't expect you to probably hold down a real good job. They just expect you, don't blow yourself up or anyone else. But God expects more. And he expects more because he knows that by his Spirit you can do more. You name the name of the Lord. And you look in church history and you see great mission movements started and launched by college students. You see martyrs who are young people, teenagers and 20-somethings, whose faith continues to reverberate today. Jim Elliott's and many more like him. And you have an opportunity to be countercultural. Because as people like me get older and older, well, I know I'm so old, you know, they expect me to say, you should grow up. And when I wrote the Emergent book, it worked because I was still sort of, well, I was never cool, you know that, but it was still at least youngish. Oh, and here's a young guy, and he's telling stuff that old people like to hear. We need to hear it from the next generation. We need to see it from you, 14-year-olds, 24-year-olds, 29-year-olds. You have an opportunity to show to the world that you're not like those people that they think they're attracting with their magazines at the checkout aisle. You're not like those people that they promote to you in all of the PG-13 wholesome, quote-unquote, movies. Because you have a different master and you serve a different Lord. And if you name the name of this Lord, you will depart from iniquity and you will pursue all of the faith and hope and love that marks out the master that you know. Let's pray. Father in heaven, perhaps a strange message to give on Easter Sunday evening, but we trust by your providence just the message that you want us to hear, and in particular these young people to hear. What a great opportunity here at University Reformed Church. We have 300 kids, more than 300 children and young people, and probably another 100 college students who come through these doors. Lord, would you help us to be faithful, to point them in a better way, a truer way? And would we see flowing from this church in the people that come as students, in our own youth that we raise up and love and disciple, a different kind of son or daughter, a different kind of culture, a different kind of hero or heroine? And help us to draw close to you and know your love, know your forgiveness, and by your Spirit to find ourselves a little bit more like you day by day. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.